come to work without pay. And we were seeing op-eds all over the country that said that if the air traffic controllers would just strike, this would be over. You don't say that to people who are locked out. You rush to their side and you stand with them and you show the boss that we're together and we're gonna stand up for the people who are being mistreated. And so, we said, we're going to strike because it is not safe. And we're calling on the rest of the labor movement to strike with us and use a general strike in this moment when 1 million people are out of work or forced to come to work without pay. And another 1 million contractors are out of work with no hope of any retroactive pay and just with no warning. I remember traveling across DC during the time, and I was talking in the car to different media outlets and talking about what we were working on. And when I got let out at my office and I went to pay the cab driver, I went to hand him a bill to pay the cab fare. And he turned around and he grabbed my hand and he had a tear coming down his cheek. And he said, "Thank you, you're fighting for me too." Because there were no cab fares as the government was shut down. We have so much more in common than anything that could ever divide us. And when we defined our power in that moment, when we said that we were going to take control, and then those 10 air traffic controllers in Jacksonville Center said that they could no longer safely do their jobs because they were exhausted with the stress and distraction of not getting a paycheck and not knowing how to take care of their families. And a few flights started to cancel in LaGuardia. And we said, "Mitch McConnell, can you hear us now?" The government shutdown was open in a matter of hours when just that morning it looked like there was no end in sight. And the reason that it was over was because workers were taking control, and the GOP understood that if workers got a taste of our power, we would upend the entire system, and the jig would be up on the 4Ds of union busting, and we would be united in demanding all of the things that are popular in this culture. Taking on climate change with good green jobs, good union jobs, making sure that everyone has access to health care, making sure that people can have a secure retirement and a safe home to live in, opening our arms to people who are destitute and just looking for a better life when they're coming to our border and hoping to contribute in our society. They knew it was all gonna be upended. And so they ended that government shutdown, not because they got their border wall, not because of anything other than the idea that working people were going to understand the power that we have. So in this moment, when things seem dire, it's really important that we remember that that power still exists every moment together. And when the Me Too movement broke, I turned around to our communications people and I said, "Get ready, the phone's going to ring." I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, they're gonna talk about people who are sexually harassed or assaulted on the jobs, and it's only gonna take them about a millisecond before they decide to call the flight attendant union." And sure enough, they started to call. And the Washington Post asked me to write an op-ed to say, what is the one thing that CEOs could do to help this issue right now? And I said, "The airline industry needs to denounce its sexist past. It needs to say there's a zero tolerance policy for this kind of action in the workplace or in travel space. And it needs to lift up flight attendants as safety professionals." And so they did that, but the other thing that we did was we put out a survey to our members because I knew what my experience had been on the job. I remembered the first year on the job when I was standing there setting up the galley and some guy comes up behind me and touches my rear end and says, "What, no girdle? How do you look this good in your uniform without a girdle?" Or all of the other times when I had someone suddenly attempting to rub my shoulders and ask me where my favorite port was to hang out with my favorite guy. I never thought that I could tell anyone about that, so I started asking my flying partners, "What's your experience?" And from 6 months to 30 years, they would talk about it, and they would say, "Yeah, we experienced this." And I say, "What do you do when it happens?" And I say, "We tell them to stop," and I go, "Every time?" And that's when the real conversation started. And they said, no, we have to de-escalate on the plane. We don't have time. We have too much to do. Also, who's going to care? And to a T, those conversations would end with, what I really had to realize was this was just part of the job. Now, that was really painful, hearing that as the flight attendant union president. And so we did collect stories, and we lifted this up because we wanted to use this moment to stamp it out. And let me just say that Peter DeFazio passed a bill that said that sexual harassment was going to be defined as one of the crimes on planes, and people were going to be fined and put in jail for even bigger penalties and bigger fees than ever before. But we weren't getting any stories from the men that I had worked with. And I got to tell you, because we had been objectified, I saw plenty of men who were sexually harassed too, sometimes much worse than anything that I had ever experienced. And so I asked them, why are you not telling your stories? Why are you not? I know that you've experienced this. And they said to a T, they said, Sarah, because this is a moment for women's equality, and we are in a bargaining unit that 80% of our flying partners are women. And if we don't stand up for women's equality, then we're never going to have the kind of bargaining power that we need to make our careers better. That is the kind of understanding that we have to have as a working class and a labor movement, to understand that when someone is diminished or when someone is treated with disdain, that is our problem too. Because we are in jeopardy too. The old adage of the labor movement, an injury to one is an injury to all, is actually not really a call to help those in need. It is a call for building our power. So it's important for us to share these stories and take this in, especially in this moment. Back to the government shutdown. I didn't once say that guy's name who was in the White House. Not one time. Because when I looked at him and all the lies he was telling, that was the very definition of what my mom and Mrs. Eddy told me was error. And you don't give error your time. And I also know that even though they're going to do everything in their power to dismantle unions, they cannot dismantle our spirit and understanding of our power together and our ability to build up community and our ability to feed each other by potluck. So this is a moment to understand that we have to start in the workplace, because our democracy does not exist because it's a beautiful idea. Our democracy exists within the backdrop of capitalism. And if we don't have the ability to put capitalism in check with workers who rise up and demand our fair share of the value, all of the value that we create in this economy, then our politics will continue to go down a road of dictatorship, of people who will build a dick rocket to go up into space and leave the rest of us on a burning earth. So I come here tonight letting you know that I fought this dude before and I'm going to fight him again. Any questions?
I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about the any collaborative efforts that are going on among the various unions with the coming conservative government.
First of all, the labor movement got to a place of being totally enamored with being irrelevant. When you're irrelevant, nobody asks what the hell you're doing, because why does anybody care? And we got bought over by this idea that our mission was labor peace. That meant there was less collective bargaining. That meant there was less people participating in union democracy. That meant there was less people understanding and experiencing what it is to feel real power with the people around you. And it also meant, frankly, that in among the management ranks, there were fewer people who were involved in collective bargaining, because at the end of the day, even though you have that power struggle, the idea is to come to an agreement. And so as unions have declined, so have the ability for us to recognize that we can come to an agreement. It's become all about who can get 51% of the public to think we're right and have the best talking points, not to get any solutions. So I'll just say that the labor movement is not a group of 100 elected union presidents who are in Washington, D.C. It's not even all the people who have a union card in their pocket today. The labor movement is every single working person who wants to have respect for themselves, a good life, and expects that for their fellow workers too. And so there's absolutely talk about, I mean, you've heard it. There was a demand by UIW to line up union contracts for May 1st, 2028. I would just say to you that that idea of workers taking on the corporate class together with big demands 4 years from now is an idea that is very powerful for this moment. And when that takes hold in the public consciousness, that creates power before feet even hit the streets. So there are people who understand power and who are trying to come together to use it, but we have to do a hell of a lot more. The labor movement has always grown when young people have taken charge. And so the last thing I would just say is that women, people of color, young people, anyone who has been marginalized is more likely to be creative and understand how to make this work in this moment. And we need to call upon people who feel like all of our power is being taken away from us, who feel like everything that we have is at risk, to rise up and understand that when we are together and we lock arms, that we have power to make the bosses yield to our demands. And the last thing I would just say about that is that it can seem all lost until it's not. There is a tipping point. They will decide to fight us until they decide it is more expensive for them to fight us than to agree with us. And it can happen in the blink of an eye. The calls for one day longer, one day stronger is no small thing. The studios wanted to starve out the writers and said they were not going to do a deal. They wanted to wait until people were losing their homes. And they thought that was going to break the picket line, but it just made the strikers mad and more committed to the fight. And at the end of the day, the workers won through that solidarity. What I would finally say is don't look for the leadership to come. Look for ways that you can lead.
This is a two-part question. How should unions rethink our political strategy and endorsement of candidates that we stop supporting corporate Democrats who are committed to perpetual war? Is it time to build an independent labor party?
Let me just say, because workers struck, because workers started to strike before the pandemic, and then continued that action through the pandemic, because Peter and I worked on a workers' first package that the airlines had to agree with, and it was the only industry not to grow in inequality because 80% of the workers are organized in the industry, and we were able to set those demands. The politics came to us. We had incredible bipartisan support because we flexed our muscles and set those demands and made them have to agree with us, even to cut their own pay and to ban stock buybacks. And the one thing that they fought to keep out of the bill, like fought tooth and nail, Delta Airlines fought tooth and nail, is the only thing they fought for, was to extract the sentence that said that no federal dollars could be spent on anti-union activity. They have money and control. We have the power. We exercise the power. We take control. We take the money. As far as the Workers' Party goes, we don't need another thing that splits us off into different groups. What we need is working class solidarity. I don't care if it's the Democrats, the Republicans, the Independents, or the purple people. If working people are expressing power, politics is going to reflect that. And so I would just say, I think it's a bit of a waste of time and effort to try to create something else, when what we really have to create is the unions that will express that power to bring the politics to us. So we have to understand that. Again, one of the four Ds, delay. So that people get tired and get desperate, right? So we gotta recognize these things and act with urgency to fix them.
How do we build international solidarity, especially with workers in places like Palestine?
Working class people are not interested in war. Working class people are interested in taking care of our families and making a better life for our children. And once again, if we focus on working class people and understand that we're calling the question on which side are you on? Are you with the billionaires? Or are you with the people that you can identify with because they take pride in doing the same job that you do? That's the only way that we're gonna change it. So we can do this when we make this real and personal to people, when people can identify with what the fight is about.
You were just listening to Sarah Nelson on Union Power. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene in mid-November 2024. Sarah Nelson is the president of the Association of Flight Attendants Union and a longtime advocate for workers' rights and unions. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Wendell Potter, Kuhan Pakmander, Ralph Nader, Peter Beinert, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Sarah Nelson on Union Power, and for Howard Zinn's classic book, A People's History of the United States, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Matt Laubach recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. Go out with Billy Bragg singing There's Power in a Union.
There's power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand.
of cowboy individualism became central to the culture of Republican politics. From 1981 to 2021, Republican policies moved more than $50 trillion from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1%. And the party stayed in power through media disinformation, voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the flood of money into politics. Those systemic changes to the political system in the United States moved the Republican Party farther and farther and farther right. And the rhetoric of cowboy individualism, as it did so, became more and more extreme.
That's Heather Cox Richardson, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Heather Cox Richardson on cowboy authoritarianism in America. We are at an inflection point. A chill is sweeping the country. We ignore it at our peril. The warning signs are everywhere. Alaska GOP Senator Lisa Murkowski says, "We are all afraid." Massachusetts Democratic Governor Maura Healey says, "The fear is real." New York Times columnist Masha Gessen writes, "America's police state has arrived." Dissent is being criminalized. People are being deported without due process. Court rulings are being ignored. Democracy, civil liberties, and free speech are all under attack. What can be done to reverse cowboy authoritarianism in America? Our guest today is Heather Cox Richardson. She's professor of history at Boston College. She previously taught at MIT. Her newsletter, Letters from an American, reaches more than a million readers. She spoke at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver on April 10, 2025. The moderator is UBC professor Heidi Twarick. And now, Heather Cox Richardson.
I wanted to talk today about what's happening in the United States and to address this question of what it means to be an American in 2025. I'm going to argue today that the crisis in today's United States is the logical outcome of 40 years of a Republican ideology that was based in the idea of cowboy individualism. That idea has directed American politics since 1980, at least, when President Ronald Reagan rode it to the White House. Those people who embrace cowboy individualism believe that a true American is a man who operates on his own, outside the community. He needs nothing from the government. He works hard to support himself. He protects his wife and his children, and he asserts his will by dominating others. That ideology is rooted in the mythological image of the American cowboy who began to drive cattle from the border of Texas and Mexico north across the plains to army posts and railheads in 1866. That image sprang to prominence in the years immediately after the Civil War, and in that peculiar moment, it took on a specific anti-government meaning. A political meaning. The Civil War government in the United States set out to protect black Americans from persecution by their white neighbors in the American South. In 1868, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution guaranteed equal protection of the laws to formerly enslaved people. And then 2 years later, in 1870, Congress created the Department of Justice to prosecute those people who attacked black Americans because of their race. So with the federal government suddenly willing to prosecute racial discrimination, former Confederates turned their racial animosity into an economic argument. Beginning in 1871, they claimed that the government's effort to protect civil rights was tantamount to socialism, because the government officials it required to protect black Americans cost tax dollars. And those tax dollars could only come from hardworking white men in the years after the Civil War. And they were providing that money to provide benefits for undeserving, they said, black people. Southern Democrats after the war contrasted that government socialism, as they called it, with the image of the American cowboy, who in their view was a young white man who wanted nothing from the government but to be left alone. The cowboy in their view was hardworking, he was good with a gun, and he dominated the women and the racial minorities he encountered in the West. That myth countered the idea that the government should protect all Americans equally. The cowboy image actually faded in the early 20th century progressive era, which is itself an interesting story, but it sprang back to prominence in the 1950s and the 1960s as a propaganda tool to oppose the wildly popular post-World War II government. That government reflected the idea that government had a role to play in regulating business, in providing a basic social safety net, in promoting infrastructure, and in protecting civil rights. And those people who were determined to get rid of government regulation and taxation resurrected the myth of the American cowboy. And they championed this idea of cowboy individualism. They embraced the idea that a government that worked for ordinary Americans was a form of socialism, because it redistributed wealth from hardworking white people to black Americans, people of color, and women who demanded equal rights. The Republicans nominated Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater, who was famous for his cowboy persona and his white cowboy hat and his opposition to the post-war government. They nominated him for president. And then, of course, in 1980, Ronald Reagan put aside his British riding clothes, put on a Western cowboy hat, and rode that ideology to the White House. That myth of cowboy individualism became central to the culture of Republican politics as a way for Republican politicians to convince voters to support the destruction of federal government programs that actually benefited them. From 1981 to 2021, Republican policies moved more than $50 trillion from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1%. And the party stayed in power through media disinformation, voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the flood of money into politics. Those systemic changes to the political system in the United States moved the Republican Party farther and farther and farther right. And the rhetoric of cowboy individualism, as it did so, became more and more extreme. They demonized non-white Americans and women in the public sphere, and they dismissed all government policies that promoted social cooperation, whether at home or abroad. And in place of the post-World War II idea of cooperation among equals, they replaced that idea with the idea that individual men should dominate society, ordering it as they thought best. Over time, white men rejected the socialization and the education that would enable them to rise to prosperity or to develop meaningful relationships. That domination to which they turned at the heart of cowboy individualism grew increasingly apparent in the United States after 1992, when the modern militia movement took off after a standoff at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, between federal marshals and a former factory worker named Randy Weaver, who had failed to show up to court for a trial on a firearms charge, convinced a number of Western men that they had to arm themselves to fight off the government. By the early 2000s in the US, gun ownership first became a symbol of cultural identity, and then it became a way to groom younger people into Republican political ideology. This is why we see political leaders posing with their families holding AR-15s on Christmas cards. The Trump administration has taken cowboy individualism now to an extreme, I believe, gutting the U.S. government and centering power in a dominant president, while also pulling the United States out of the web of international organizations that have stabilized the globe since World War II. The administration began its run in 2025 by firing the women and the racial and gender minorities who held positions in the government. But it is not just exercising domination over others, it is reveling in that dominance and advertising it, especially over the migrants it has sent to prison in El Salvador, showing films of them being transported in chains and displaying caged prisoners behind Homeland Security Kristi Noem, who in those photographs and in that film is wearing a $50,000 gold Rolex watch. In place of cooperation, the Trump administration's determination to exercise its dominance shows, I think, in its plan to invest $1 trillion in the military after gutting the U.S. Agency for International Development, also known as USAID. Trump has always seen power as a zero-sum game in which for one party to win, others must lose. If, in fact, Trump succeeds in asserting his dominance over the United States of America and over the globe, the Republicans will have succeeded in replacing American democracy with a dictatorship, and they will have rebalanced global power. But, you know with me, there's always a but, right? Those who believe in that ideology of cowboy individualism have not yet established that autocracy that is their endgame, in large part because that cowboy ideology is a myth. It has never reflected reality. And right now, MAGA Republicans are watching in real time as their president, Donald Trump, lumps them in with the minorities and people of color they believed were inferior to them. The government programs that Republicans are calling wasteful are not just the ones that supported racial minorities. They are the ones that supported MAGA Republicans. Cowboy individualism was always a myth. It never represented the United States of America. It didn't even represent the cowboys, one-third of whom were black or were men of color, and whose employment actually replicated the low pay and dangerous conditions of Eastern factory workers. In fact, the American West was a multicultural world in which the key to surviving and even prospering was not dominating other people, it was kinship ties and communities. Famous Western trader Kit Carson, for example, often lionized as the real hero of cowboy individualism, spoke English, Spanish, a number of indigenous languages, and was married three times, two times to an indigenous woman, and then to a Mexican woman. When Eastern settlers moved west, they depended on communities to enable them to survive disasters because, for example, every single farm would lose a barn to fire at some point, and you needed to have people for barn raising. That focus on communities in the American West gave the United States of America grassroots political movements, which were named, after all, for the prairie grasses, whose roots can go as deep as 3.5 meters. Those movements included the late 19th century Alliance Movement and the populist movements in the late 19th century that reordered American politics. Central to those movements, those grassroots movements, were the Western women who organized to fund churches and to fund schools and who drove Western politics. For example, when the Western state of Iowa added murals to its state house in 1908 to portray the modern government, the duties of defense, charities, education, and the executive, legislative, and the judiciary, it illustrated those aspects of modern American government, all except defense and legislature, it portrayed them as women. The contrast between the myth of cowboy individualism and the reality of life in the American West matters because they represent two very different versions of the American government. Iowa's depiction of the modern government as support for an inclusive society in which women took full part was part of a larger movement in the early 20th century to change the nature of American government itself. Key to that change was social worker Frances Perkins, which is why you've been hearing so much about her from me lately. As a settlement house worker, she saw firsthand what economists will tell you today, that modern industrialization could not survive without the labor and the participation of the entire community, not just male factory workers, who were actually paid lower than survival wages. Later, when she witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911, Perkins also saw what happened to communities without government regulation and social services. I can't begin to tell you how disturbed the people were everywhere, Perkins recalled after the fire. It was as though we had all done something wrong. It shouldn't have been. We were sorry. We didn't want it that way. We hadn't intended to have 147 girls and boys killed in a factory. It was a terrible thing for the people of the city of New York and the state of New York to face. With her help, the New York Democratic machine remade New York state politics to address the needs of the entire community. When Perkins became Secretary of Labor under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, she took that new government philosophy to the federal level, where she ushered in a dramatic change to the nature of the federal government. With the 1935 Social Security Act, Perkins did more than provide benefits for the elderly and orphans. She created a new kind of United States government. Before Perkins, the primary function of the federal government was to manage the economic relationships between labor, capital, and resources. Property rights, after all, had been the basis on which North American colonists had found the justification, the legal justification, to rebel against the British crown. And the focus on the relationships inherent in property ownership had continued to dominate the government that American lawmakers built afterward. But Perkins recognized that the end of government was not to protect property. It was to protect the communities of people who lived in the nation. She recognized that children, the elderly, women, and disabled Americans were as valuable to that community as the young male workers and the wealthy men who employed them. And she molded the government to reflect the idea that the equal value of all Americans meant that they should all have equal protection of the laws and equal access to resources, including social services like health care, education, and child care. Her vision of the U.S. government reflected reality. But Perkins' recognition of community as the heart of the nation directly challenged the power of men who could dominate a world that had been defined by economic relationships. As soon as the Social Security Act passed, opponents worked to destroy it and the new idea of government that it represented. Reaching back to the past, they claimed that such a government would destroy men's willingness to work and ruin the individualism that made America great. In the 1930s, as soon as the New Deal reorganized government around communities, established businessmen set out to resurrect that old form of government, that old economic ideology. And to bolster their support, they welcomed racists who opposed the idea of equal rights for racial and ethnic minorities to their coalition, and that unholy alliance has been well studied. But they also turned to religious traditionalists who had stood against the teaching of evolution in the Scopes trial just a dozen years before the passage of the Social Security Act. Religious traditionalists, especially those in the Southern Baptist Convention, opposed the new system because it recognized equal rights for women. Women's equality, they believed, meant the end of the patriarchy that they thought mirrored God's relationship to his people, and they saw it as an affront to God. Their position that the modern government was un-American then was strengthened in 1962 when the Supreme Court decided the Engle v. Vitale decision, which struck down state-mandated prayer in public schools, and then in 1963 when Abingdon School District v. Shemp prohibited teachers from leading students in prayer or Bible readings. The Supreme Court decisions against prayer in the schools reinforced the idea that the modern government opposed family values. That religious traditionalism took political shape in 1967 when Southern Baptist leaders Paul Pressler and Paige Patterson plotted to take the Southern Baptists back to an older view of the world. They focused on the inerrancy of the Bible, that is, the Bible can't be wrong, but it was really about women's rights, their ideology. They were denying women's equality and pushing them back into a position subordinate to men. By 1972, the issue of abortion would bring this sexist religious backlash into American politics. Abortion had become a centerpiece of the post-World War II government after doctors identified abortion access as a major public health issue in the 1960s. They estimated that there were between 200,000 and 1.2 million illegal U.S. abortions a year, endangering the lives of women, primarily poor women who could not afford a workaround. By 1972, 64% of Americans believed that abortion should be a question answered by a woman and her doctor. 68% of Republicans believed that. But in 1972, before Roe v. Wade, President Richard Nixon was up for re-election, and he and his people were terrified that he would lose the election. So his advisor Pat Buchanan urged Nixon to woo Catholic Democrats before the election by turning to the issue of abortion. Although Nixon had virtually the same platform on the issue as Democratic nominee George McGovern, Nixon and Buchanan defined McGovern as the candidate of acid, amnesty for draft dodgers, and abortion, a radical framing designed to attract traditionalists to the Republican Party. As Nixon split the U.S. in two to rally voters, his supporters used abortion to stand in for women's rights in general. Railing against women's equal rights, in her first statement on abortion in 1972, again the year before Roe versus Wade, activist Phyllis Schlafly did not talk about fetuses, but she talked about women's equality. Women's Lib, short for Women's Liberation, is a total assault on the role of the American woman as wife and mother, and on the family as the basic unit of society. Women's Libbers are trying to make wives and mothers unhappy with their career, make them feel that they are second-class citizens and abject slaves. They are promoting federal daycare centers for babies instead of homes. They are promoting abortions instead of families. In 1979, the first deadline for the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment enshrining women's rights in the U.S. Constitution passed with the amendment unratified, and candidate Ronald Reagan welcomed right-wing Southern Baptist leaders like Pat Robertson, Billy Graham, and Jerry Falwell into his coalition. As the power of those evangelicals grew, Republican culture attacked the modern government by relegating women to the roles of wives and mothers or as sex objects. With talk radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh referring to women who wanted equal rights as feminazis who were destroying society, and after 1996, the Fox News Channel portrayed women's ideal submissive role quite carefully as younger women deferred to older white male hosts like Bill O'Reilly and displayed their bodies under low-cut shirts and short skirts that could be seen under the new glass desks that they used on those sets. But this attempt to undermine the modern government was running up against women's changing political voice. American women tended to vote as their husbands did until 1980, when political observers first saw a gender gap in voting. Women turn out in higher numbers to vote than men do, and at higher rates, and they vote for Democratic candidates at higher rates than men do. If you break that statistic down by race, the numbers are even starker, with black women and women of color voting in significantly higher percentages for Democratic candidates than men do. So the attempt to get rid of the modern American state began to take shape as an evangelical emphasis on gender domination in households. Wildly popular books and religious culture emphasized a woman's duty to produce a lot of children and to do as her husband or father told her. In 2014 and 2015, this impulse to remove the equality of women from American society showed in Gamergate, when men complained about their inability to find women who would date them and began to call themselves incels or involuntary celibates, and began to refer to women as NPCs, non-player characters, who are there to make the story move forward for the playing characters. By the way, a term that you see Elon Musk using a lot these days. When you see NPCs, that's what he's talking about. In the 2016 campaign, Republican candidate Donald Trump faced off against Hillary Clinton, who had so specifically defended the idea of a community-based government that she wrote a book titled It Takes a Village. Trump demonstrated his dominance over Clinton by physically looming over her at a debate. He called for her to be jailed, and then he boasted of sexual assault. But that boast of sexual assault did not end his candidacy, it strengthened it, as a certain group of Republicans saw attacks on women as attacks on the government that they hated. Once in power, Trump gave the evangelicals what they wanted by stacking the Supreme Court with justices who would overturn abortion rights. In 2025, Trump returned to power by warning voters that the modern American state was literally turning boys into girls, while his vice president, J.D. Vance, urged women to embrace traditional gender roles, including staying in abusive marriages for the sake of the children. In contrast, Democratic candidates Vice President Kamala Harris and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz emphasized community and the role of government in protecting that community.
You're listening to Heather Cox Richardson on Cowboy Authoritarianism in America. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Now, Trump's MAGA Republicans control all the branches of the government, but it is not clear that they will be able to suppress the vast majority of Americans who continue to support the government that Francis Perkins ushered in 90 years ago. For one thing, Republican voters are learning that the government they thought was helping women and minorities actually helps them and kept the nation safe. But there's also a key factor at play right now that is coming to a conclusion after the long-standing Republican attacks on women. As they did in Perkins's era, women are still central to the American community, but now there is a twist. Two generations of women striving for education meant that men backed away from professions once women reached parity in those professions, and now women are dominating educational achievement in the United States, making them more prepared for a modern government than young men are. The past 40 years has also created a new demographic. Women now have educations and connections, they have skills, often they have money, and the people who are now in the boomer generation and slightly below it are the first generation of American women to have 20 to 30 years after their children leave home to invent a second career. Many of them are turning to issues they care about, including political organizing. Indeed, so nervous are MAGA Republican leaders about women's political roles that they're trying to throw women out of political power altogether. The House passed the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or the SAVE Act, which would require all American voters to prove they are citizens by presenting documentation in person when registering to vote or updating their voter registration information. But the kicker is that your official identification has to match your current name. That means that it would disfranchise as many as 69 million American women who do not have passports and whose birth certificates are not in their current married names. That SAVE Act, I think, dovetails with the extraordinary misogyny that has come to dominate the MAGA Republican Party. And I'm going to argue that it is not an accident that the current attempt in the United States to overthrow democracy presents as an attack on American women. American women created and then maintained the American state the Trump administration is currently dismantling. Whether they will save it and realize the government Francis Perkins set out to establish 90 years ago, a government based in the reality that the community is the centerpiece of American society, or whether they won't, is the story of America not just in this moment, but for our future. And I always like to point out that it's worth remembering that the mythological cowboy never stuck around. He actually rode off into the sunset and left the people behind to govern the community. Thank you very much.
One of the things we keep reading in the newspapers today is how unprecedented everything that the Trump administration has been doing over the last few months is. And I wonder if you as the historian can take a bit of a step back for us and separate out a little bit the things that you really think are unprecedented about what we've been seeing in the last few months.
It's dizzying, isn't it? So I am one of the people who called it a constitutional crisis from very early days. And the reason for that, and the reason I was impatient with those who did not, is because our Constitution is really very clear. And the clarity of where the government power comes from is also quite clear. And it comes from we the people, which might be worth picking up. But in our Constitution, there's three main articles. So when someone talks about Article 2 powers, that's what they're talking about, is what's in that. Article 1 sets up the lawmaking bodies of the United States government, and that is the House of Representatives and Congress and the Senate that are the legislative body. That is the only body in the federal government that can write a law, that can make a law. And the Article II powers are the powers of the president. And the president's duty is to execute the laws, make sure that they are carried out in good faith. So the minute that the Trump administration got into power and withheld the appropriations that had been made by Congress for the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is a congressionally established agency, he was taking the power of Congress, one of our three branches of government, and relegating it to himself. That is a constitutional crisis that is explicitly against the law, and according to the 1974 Impoundment Control Act, which said to Richard Nixon, you can't do this. This is what Trump was impeached for in 2019 when he withheld money that had been appropriated for the Ukraine's military. And that, right out of the box, was the first thing that was unprecedented. But since then, of course, we have the problem of the fact that the Trump administration is operating outside the Constitution. They're not just breaking the laws, they're acting extra constitutionally, which makes things really difficult because we have systems set up for when people break the laws. We don't have systems set up for when people say, I'm going to pull this billionaire off the street, give him access to all Americans' data, and you know, good luck with that. So in doing so, in working outside the Constitution, they have created many different places in which they have broken laws, which is going to make it very hard for them to back down. And then the other thing is the quite deliberate destruction of the different pieces of our Bill of Rights that protect liberties. And those are ramping up on a daily basis with the idea, I think, of overawing people so they don't fight back. But so far, it's had the opposite effect. A lot of people who otherwise wouldn't be paying very close attention notice when a graduate student gets kidnapped off the streets and sent to prison in Louisiana.
Yeah, and I think your description of a constitutional crisis is one way of trying to express there's something really unprecedented about this. There's something urgent. It is some kind of emergency. One of the other ways that prominent historians have been trying to do that, like Ruth Ben-Ghiat or Tim Snyder, is through comparisons with fascism. And I wonder if you could just reflect a little bit about whether you think is that useful or not, or do you want to keep rooting it as you do really in American history?
There's two ways to answer that, and one of the ways in which we're in quite unusual territory for the United States is we have in power a group of people who are actively trying to destroy democracy. Now, we've had that in the States before. If you think about the American South from about 1874 to about 1965, those were one-party states in which not everybody enjoyed equality before the law. In fact, very few people enjoyed equality before the law. But this is the first time we actually have people in America doing it. So I'm one of those annoying people who doesn't like the word fascism, because fascism has a number of economic policies that the Trump administration is really not embracing in favor of authoritarianism. And in that, we're in a new moment, I think, and this is not new to me saying this. There's a number of people who study, for example, international crime, who noticed within about 15 years ago that the criminals around the world are working together with political leaders and sometimes lawmakers to create a new kind of power structure, a criminal power structure, around the entire globe. And so if you think about what the Trump administration is trying to do, to me it looks much more like somebody like Viktor Orban in Hungary, who of course has a much smaller country than the United States is, but Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, for example, literally took a number of the laws that they've put in place in Florida from laws that Viktor Orban put in place in Hungary, and the right-wing conservative political action committee, not committee, conference, has of course had Viktor Orban come speak, and they have had their Tucker Carlson go and interview Orban a number of times. So when I think about what I see in the United States right now, when I look at what the Trump administration is doing, I think the models are much more the kind of model you see in other countries than even in some place like the American South. So that's the direction that I would look. And while fascism is a very useful term for the destruction of rights and liberties, I study the economy, so I'm kind of like, that's not quite what he's doing, because if you look at the tariffs, for example, the sheer caprice of them is something that you'd have a much harder time getting through a fascist system than you would through an authoritarian system. So you can call it fascist if you want, but I'm much more into authoritarianism.
I think there are uses that many of these authors have for calling it fascism, which I think try and draw attention to this as a crisis, right? And that's part of it. But there are also a huge number of distinctions. The way that I've thought about it is what Robert Paxton talks about, where one of the most famous people talking about fascism, his view has been, we could call this fascist, but it's also not helpful politically. It doesn't really get us anywhere. And I think that's actually quite helpful. So the way that I've been thinking about it, to move to my next question, is to draw on what Daniel Ziblatt, political scientist, has been talking about when he's been describing what Trump is aiming at as something more akin to competitive authoritarianism. There'll still be elections, but it's going to be harder and harder for the Democrats to win. So I'd love to hear a little bit more of your reflections on that, whether it's comparisons with Hungary or Turkey. Do you see competitive authoritarianism as a better description of where the U.S. might be heading?
I do, and I love his work. And yes, the concept of competitive authoritarianism is that, yes, there will always be elections, but you already know who's going to win one of them. And that's the same kind of things you saw in Russia or in Hungary are exactly the same things you're seeing here, an attempt really to crack down on the media, to delegitimize opponents, political opponents. But to maybe add a little bit to something that he said, I have been fascinated for years now by the concept that is associated with Russian political theorists, but I have never been convinced that it came entirely from Russian political theorists. And that is the concept of virtual technology or virtual politics. And that's the idea of creating a false reality around which voters come to cast their votes. So they believe they're voting for something they are not, which, if you're following American politics right now, you don't have to go real far to look at people going, he's doing what with the tariffs? That's not what I voted for. But that idea of using a fake reality to convince people to vote away their own democracy. One of the reasons I don't think it is associated, I don't associate it only with Russia, is because that's really been something that...
4 years ago, Texas experienced its worst blackout in state history. But there's one factor that never got much attention.
Natural gas failed in a big way.
The gas system that feeds many power plants simply didn't work. But why?
There's no plausible explanation for it other than a manipulation of price and a manipulation of supply.
Season 3 of The Disconnect.